The meeting in order.
Kelly, we call the roll.
Ray Deanda?
Here.
Jimmy Martini?
Here.
Gordon Ford?
Here.
Darren Garrett?
Here.
Jeff Grover? Mike Lynch?
Here.
Joan Condon? Ron Martin?
Here.
Michael O'Neill?
Here.
Donna Riley?
Here.
The first item is announcements. Are there any announcements from the staff or board? Okay. Public comments. Are there any public comments for items that are not on the agenda? Anybody here? Okay, consent calendar.
Move to approve.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Paul, you're up.
First, we have the semi-annual performance by Delaware Investments, our active large cap growth manager. And we have Kevin and Kim, who will give their semi-annual report.
Go into a little bit more detail about process of
right. We're going back to six.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for having us. My name's Kim Aspenleiter. I'm the client service representative for the relationship between Stanislaus and Delaware. Kevin Brown, who's with me, is the investment specialist who works directly with the team in San Francisco. So I figured, since there's so many, we've got new board members, new people here, spend a brief few more moments than we normally would talking about just the Delaware's organization, and Kevin can do the same about the philosophy and process. And as always, if you have any questions, please just feel free to interrupt and ask us any questions. In the book, the first section is really about the firm overview. From page 1.1 gives really a snapshot of Delaware Investments as of June 30th. Just a timeline, but I would point you down to the middle part of the page with the assets. It's got a breakdown by asset class, kind of the profile of the assets. So it shows really there we have a firm that manages a number of different kinds of asset classes. Year over year, this has grown by about $24 billion. This is unfortunately come down a little bit since June 30th. But of the growth, that was both market appreciation and new accounts coming in, so they're positive flows coming into the firm. The breakdown of the firm, we have both retail and institutional and clients in all of those. So there's been no real change in the breakdown of the assets or the type of assets that we manage. The next page is just a representative client list. You look through there, you see some names you would probably recognize, including yourself.
The ones in bold, by the way, are the accounts that our team, our growth team in San Francisco, manages. So.
Page 1.3 and 1.4 is just some information on kind of how Delaware works. Delaware, I would describe as kind of a boutique within a larger structure. So we have individual investment teams that manage their process. They have their own clients, they have their own process, they have their own research, and they work within the structure of Delaware that provides client service, legal, compliance, back office. So they are all doing their own thing. It's not a we don't have a common research platform. They will have their own opinions on the markets, they do their own research, they pick their own stocks. Delaware doesn't say, here's a Delaware opinion on what's going to happen with the market, because it really depends on what team and what they're talking about, what they're thinking. All right. So other than that, that's kind of really the structure of Delaware that this team works within. And I'll just pass it over to Kevin, because I think that's what you want to hear about.
Yeah. So if there are other questions about organizational structure or the way that we're set up, I'm happy to go to the next section, and I can do a 5-minute version of this. Actually, I'd ask you to skip another section and go to the third section, and I can do a 5-minute version on this 3.1 page, which is the basics on the way that we manage money, again, for newer folks. And again, happy to speed up or slow down. Basically, have three main philosophy points. One is that we do believe in concentrated portfolios. That's roughly 25 to 30 stocks. We've been managing this large cap growth strategy with a GIPS compliant, just a audited compliant record going back to 94, and frankly even before that. And it's always been this kind of 25 to 30, we think is the right sweet spot number of stocks that give us the best risk reward trade off in a portfolio. Currently, I think we own 28 stocks right now. So we believe in that concentrated approach. The second thing is we believe in a long term time horizon. We're trying to own stocks what we call through a market cycle, and that's, you know, we use the years 3 to 5 years. It just so happens there's no magic number to a time horizon point estimate. The point is what we're not doing is we're not doing sector rotation. We're not trying to time cycles, whether it's an economic cycle or an investment sentiment cycle. We're truly trying to find companies we can own for several years that have some kind of competitive advantage and defendable position and a good business model we think can survive in a variety of environments. And so that lends itself to about a 30% turnover, roughly turn about a third of the portfolio over. That includes adds and trims, by the way. So we're not always taking a third of the portfolio and selling it and buying a new third, but that's generally how the kind of math works out. There's very few major transactions per year. And then the last thing here is a focus on the growth of what we call intrinsic business value, just meaning the real cash economics of a business, as if we were a private owner and we're giving the company a dollar. What does that dollar actually generate in terms of excess cash flow that's available to us as stockholders? And we think this is why it's the top bullet point there under strengths. We think it's the most differentiating thing we do relative to most growth investors. Most growth investors will look at some kind of revenue rate or growth rate or earnings, reported earnings growth, or some kind of growth metric, traditional growth metric. We're happy to have companies that have those kinds of growth metrics, but to us it's much more important as to what the real underlying cash economics are. You can get good revenue growth, you can even get good reported earnings growth and be destroying capital if you're throwing lots of capital at a business. If you're out there buying real estate, building stores, whatever the case may be, and spending, you know, in some cases billions of dollars just to buy revenues, that's not necessarily a value-creating event. It's not necessarily a good thing for shareholders. So again, it's really all about following the cash flows of a company and seeing if those cash flows are available to us as shareholders, and then what we're willing to pay for that cash flow stream. Those are the things that are important to us. So those are the three main things. Just briefly, the way we're structured and the way the process works. There's 12 of us in an office in San Francisco. As Kim said, it's a kind of boutique, firm of boutique model. I think there's 8 investment teams in Delaware. We happen to be the only one out on the West Coast. Most of them are in Philadelphia. There's a few in Boston. So when you come to our offices, you'll see basically 12 people in an office, 8 people on the investment team. Those 8 people are all generalists because we're only owning 25 or 30 stocks in a portfolio. We don't believe in sector specialization. We're not trying to be experts per se in any particular sector. We're trying to find 25 to 30 great investment ideas to own at any given time. We also do things so collaboratively. Those 8 people get around a table and collaborate a lot and discuss ideas that we don't like the idea of there being an expert in any particular field that can kind of stifle the conversation. So everyone's a generalist. Everyone approaches investments from a more kind of pure investment point of view. What stock could I own versus all the others, and I'm only going to own about 25 or 30. We like that kind of generalist approach. Everything we do is teamed up. Every stock that we're researching has 2 people on it that are a sponsor and a co-sponsor, and those 2 people come and pitch the team. They don't come and pitch our large cap growth portfolio managers, for example. They come pitch the other 6 people on the team, and the other 6 people on the team are expected to have an opinion. They're expected to challenge the assumptions of the pitch, and collaboratively we get to what we think is the right answer, and we like that combination of the individuals going off and doing the hard, detailed work, coming to the group, and this group vetting process gets us to what we think is the right answer. And so again, like I said, very collaborative, kind of trying to marry the individual responsibility with the collaborative group effort we think gets us to good answers. So that's really it on the main philosophy and process points. Again, happy to go into anything else. On 3.2, you'll just see that's the list of people on the team, and the first 8 people on that list are the team. And the big takeaway here is that we have not had a change in this team, not since just you guys hired us, but we haven't had a change in this team for 7 years when we added a couple people to this team. We haven't had a departure since 2001. So there's been obviously a lot of dislocation, disruption in the markets over the last 3 years, let alone the last decade or so. And this team's stayed intact, so lots of stability experience and no plans for that to change at all. On the right side of the page, is these are the five strategies. The one we're talking about here is large cap growth. Just to be clear, there's five products here, but we own just a total of 75 stocks across all of these products. There's lots of overlap here. So I think some people might look at a five strategy team, $13 million in assets, and think, geez, that seems like a lot for eight people on an investment team. Again, just to be clear, you know, 75 stocks total, and 10 of the $13 billion is a large cap growth strategy that we're talking about here. I think I hit, Kim, unless there's something you can think of.
No, I think
those are the main points. I'm happy to go into detail on any of them or move on to portfolio performance. Or
I just have a question.
Of course.
You hold the whole 3 to 5 years, and your group determines that. At some point, somebody says, hey, I think maybe we need to look at X to sell.
Yep.
So they just come in and say, we think it's time to sell X. What's the longest you've ever hung on to?
There are stocks that we have owned that we still own. I can think of one for, two stocks we've owned for over 10 years. So we think there's good reasons for it. Qualcomm happens to be one of them. I think we've owned that one for 12 years. And to be fair, it hasn't always been an alpha producing stock for us over those 12 years, right? There have been periods from 06 to maybe the beginning of 09, it was hurting us. And so, you know, theoretically, every single day, we're looking at these portfolios. We do it in practice, but what I'm saying is that theoretically we can make any change at any time. So you have to kind of rebuy your portfolio every day. Even if you have a long-term investment horizon, the goal is do you have 25 to 30 stocks in there that you think you can own for the next 3 to 5,
okay,
whether we bought them a week ago or whether we bought them 10 years ago.
No.
And so, but generally what would happen is that you would either have the team talking about why a particular stock isn't working or having an opinion on it, or you have the analysts who are the sponsors coming forward and say, look, our thesis was this, it's not working out. You can see that in the way the stock behaves, or in some cases, stocks that are working, but they need to be sold for some reason. Either they've hit a valuation target or we're starting to feel, you know, questionable about the fundamentals going forward. And those are obviously the best examples if you can find ones that you can sell on strength.
But 3 to 5 is not a lock. You don't say,
no.
We've had this 5 years.
The 3 to 5 is the goal of the kind of time horizon we want to talk about and think about when we're buying stocks and when we currently own them. The average holding period probably ends up being about 4 or 5 years because we have some very long held stocks.
I would also mention that it's conviction weighted portfolio.
So that's right. Yeah, that's a very good point. I should have said that earlier. Even though it's 25 to 30 stocks, we're not looking for 25 to 30 home runs. You know, let's just take a flyer on 30 stocks. We weight in the portfolio usually about a 2% is the bottom and about a 5-6, sometimes even 7% single position at the top. So all of those different stocks have different, what we think are different risk reward characteristics, and we'll weight them accordingly. And we can be a nice segue if you'd like. But one of the reasons. One thing worth mentioning is our quarterly performance that's going to end here in a few days has been very, very good. One of the reasons is there's obviously a lot of risk aversion and concern about the economic cycle, et cetera. And we do have some cyclical exposure in our portfolio, some companies that are more exposed to economic cyclicality than others. But where we have that kind of cyclicality, it tends to be in the bottom half, usually even the bottom third of our portfolio. So We've managed to do much better than the market because we just haven't been too exposed to the cycle. And when we do, it's important how you weight that kind of exposure. So you're right. It's completely risk-reward weighted on an individual stock level. And then in aggregate, we look at it and say, do we have the right risk exposures at the top, middle, bottom? Any other questions? Anything we've talked about? Or should I just move to portfolio specifics? Does that make sense? If we back up a section, sorry to jump around, I'm just trying to get us to what the most relevant points are. And the second section is where the specifics on the portfolio are with the AUM on the front page of 2.1 is what I'm looking at, inception period and just some of the assets under management detail. The next page is some performance data through June, which obviously we want to do is get you the most recent quarter. But again, since we're at the end of September, And in this case, anyway, I promise we're not just doing this because the numbers are good in this quarter. We would do this anyway because this is all the way almost to a full quarter lag. We gave you another page that just got us through August. And just to give you a little bit more of a real-time, more recent, and that's what the next page on 2.3 is, just a little bit more recent performance. And happy to talk about any of the performance periods. Happy to talk about, we gave you some top five and bottom five in terms of what, on a relative basis, stocks that have been hurting performance and stocks that have been helping. You can see through in the August one and 2.3, and again, I wouldn't necessarily come in here and quote quarterly numbers, you know, again, to the conversation about 3 to 5 horizons. But the quarterly performance, to be fair, has been really, really outstanding. And it's worth mentioning that just because of how extreme the market's been and how volatile it's been. And our quarterly performance were almost 4 percentage points better than the market just in the September quarter alone through yesterday. So it's pretty meaningful. It's had a pretty meaningful impact across all these time periods, including the since inception period, which you see on 2.3, which is maybe 20 basis points ahead. And, you know, through yesterday, it's now more like 40. So we're starting to now have not only dug out of the since inception hole that we were in with you guys, but now going ahead. So anyway, I thought that was worth mentioning just because it's been so meaningful. Are there any questions? I can, if you want, and maybe to anticipate a question, the reason on the quarterly performance, and then I promise I'll be quiet and listen for a question, is we tend to have a, for lack of a better word, a quality focus in our portfolios. We have this, we always have this. You can't have 3 to 5 year time horizons and not have some sense of quality as we define it. We define quality more on qualitative fundamental factors. Where a company is in its life cycle, what its competitive position is, the volatility of its revenues and cash flows, the quality of its management, the capital structure of a company, does it have cash on the balance sheet, does it have a lot of debt, how levered is the business, all those fundamental qualitative factors factor into what we consider quality. And for the most part, we have a couple exceptions, happy to talk about them, but for the most part, we tend to have companies that have great competitive positions, that don't have debt issues, that are self-financing, they don't need financing in the capital markets, that have business models that generate high returns. They may be growth. We have some very growthy companies in here. Apple is maybe one of the most obvious examples, and it's our top-rated stock, but it doesn't mean that Apple is growthy with lots of risk attached. It's growthy with all kinds of cash, in fact, way too much cash, and a fundamental profile that looks outstanding. So because of that quality bias, when you get these kinds of market environments, generally people tend to make decisions, you know, they will snap to, okay, what am I going to own? Am I going to own stock A or stock B? And these kinds of environments, especially ones that where the growth of the economy is big in question, they will pay up for growth, if you will, and they'll pay up for competitive positions, and they'll pay up for companies that have some kind of secular growth story that aren't so tied to the economy and kind of cyclical factors. And so we've done very well there. And this has generally been true over the few decades we've been doing this strategy. It's generally true, not always, there's been a couple exceptions, but generally true that our performance does very well on a relative basis in these down markets and the big sell-offs.
What's your latest peer ranking?
Peer ranking, yeah. In terms of Morningstar and yeah. Lipper and things like that? I don't have them on me, but we were comfortably in the top decile year to date. I think we're in the top quartile now all the way through the 3 year period. So top decile 1 year, I honestly don't know what it is, third year. 5 year, we're about 30th percentile. Just cracking, trying to crack the top quartile.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I can forward those to Paul.
Yeah, those are easy to get.
And Kevin, can you, given the extreme environment, there appears to be a lot of companies on valuation basis that are, quote, cheap. Mm-hmm. Yet, your portfolio, I see one new name, Caterpillar, I think Bank of New York is out.
Yeah.
How's that affect looking at all these new names screening out versus what's in the portfolio? Like, Visa and MasterCard have run pretty well.
Yeah.
maybe aren't as cheap as some of these cheap names coming up? And then secondly, can you talk about all these macro events have had the effect of slowing down global GDP forecasts? Have you seen that yet at the companies in your portfolio level as profitability going forward being slashed?
Or? Yeah. Okay. So in the first one, in terms of things tend to get cheaper with 15 to 20% sell-offs. Yeah. You know, it's that's true, although, you know, back to the idea of cash flow orientation as opposed to just pure PE multiples, that's something that, that we think gives us a little bit of an advantage in that we try to arbitrage relative to the market, where the market tends to think, the consensus in the market tends to think more in terms of PEs and relative PEs in certain sectors and versus other stocks. The Caterpillar one is maybe a good example where we're happy that we have this quality bias, happy that for years now we've had the sense that you couldn't really have a huge boom recovery on the backs of how much problems were created 3 years ago, and that the recovery is going to be kind of moderate at best. So we're currently kind of right on that outlook, and happy that the portfolio is behaving the way it has. But it doesn't mean that we're not trying to be opportunistic at times. And Cat is a good example where the market has taken the idea that we're back to the races or this could be a great recovery and just thrown it out the window and then, you know, stomped on its head. And in that environment, we don't think CAT was necessarily even priced going into this sell-off as if there was going to be some great recovery that Caterpillar was going to benefit from. So that's a case where we're not necessarily resting on our laurels and saying, great, we had a quality bias and now the market sold off and we're winning currently. That's a case of trying to be optimistic and try to grab Caterpillar on something we call time arbitrage, which is the market tends to be very short-term focused. If the economy is going to slow and China now is in concern about how fast it's going to grow, they just hammer Caterpillar. And so we just stepped in and took a 1.5%, 2% position weight in Caterpillar. But it's not just because it's cheap. We don't buy stocks just because we think they're cheap. In Caterpillar's case, it is often just a cyclical play. Right now, we believe Caterpillar is kind of interesting, not to go into too much details. I doubt you'd really want to hear. But basically, with the two interesting things about Caterpillar is it has a new management team as of a little over a year ago. And we think they're a management team that speaks our language in terms of returns on capital and are thinking about kind of cash flows and shareholder return the right way. And the second interesting thing in Caterpillar is they bought a company earlier this year called Bacyrus, which is in the mining business. And it was a large one, but it could be pretty meaningful in terms of changing kind of their cash flows over time. So you've got these two things that are going on under the hood that are really interesting, and we're getting a chance to buy it when the market doesn't want any kind of cyclicality. So trying to be a little bit optimistic there, thinking in the next 3 to 5 years, that's going to be a good entry point. You do have to be careful about valuation. Just because things get cheaper doesn't mean you initially want to own them. And as you said, the hurdle rate is, can you get something that's better than what you have in the portfolio? We don't necessarily have to sell one when we buy one. But we do believe in the idea of shelf space, that a 2 or 3% position in the portfolio is a big deal. And so if we're going to give a company 2% you know, weight in the portfolio, it's gonna have to be more compelling, more interesting than everything we have in there. And then your second question had to do more with the macro.
How's it affecting companies in your portfolio?
Well, that's right. In some cases, it's obvious where we've had, I mentioned earlier, where we've had some cyclical exposure in the portfolio, companies like Expeditors, which is a global logistics, you know, global trade company, Staples, you know, the office supply company, Lowe's to an extent, although Lowe's is doing a lot of good things that's offsetting some of these things. So those kinds of companies have felt it, and you've been able to see it for the last couple quarters. But honestly, most of our companies, it's not that they're totally immune to it. That would be wrong. But companies like Nike that are putting up really good numbers, and the stocks are really reflecting it well. Walgreens has a little bit of controversy right now because they're having a big fight with Express Scripts, and that's getting a lot of headlines. But the operating performance at Walgreens has been very, very good. You know, in the portfolio itself, and we've seen this in the last 3 months where you've had companies report their quarters, they're actually hanging in there pretty well, and they're actually doing pretty well, and the stocks are really, really in a market that's selling off 15-20%, and a company can report a quarter that is at or beats kind of consensus expectations, and those stocks can be up, you know, 4 or 5% in a day when stocks are down 1 and 2% in total, and so that's obviously helped our relative. So haven't seen, you know, kind of a lot of the slowdown currently anyway show up in the portfolio yet. Yeah, that's been very encouraging.
You stated 2% is a big deal as far as the portfolio, yet it's interesting to note that the number one stock has more than 2% of the portfolio above even number two. You're very heavily weighted into one stock, which is Apple.
Yes.
Obviously, there's news with jobs and everything else.
Yeah.
Can you take us forward with your thinking on Apple?
Yeah, Apple is a big bet in the portfolio, but it's not even as big a bet as it used to be, only because Apple has grown so much that it's now, I think it's like 6% of the Russell 1000 growth. It's 8% of our portfolio as of yesterday because it's relatively done so well recently. But relative to kind of the benchmark weight, it's not even as big a bet as it was maybe 2 or 3 years ago. But to your point, it is a big bet, make no mistake. It is the number one position because it just has... It has by far and away the best fundamental profile right now of any company in the portfolio, meaning the growth rate is still pretty staggering for as big a company as that is. The growth rate that they are getting on the iPhone and the iPad is pretty staggering, on top of what's already a growth rate in traditional laptop and desktop that is much better than the general PC market out there. So in every product line, they are absolutely not only crushing the competition, but, you know, 2 or 3% GDP growth, and that company's growing 30-something percent. It's pretty staggering. The reason why we think there's runway to that it's not just everything that's good till now, this is still, as hard as it is for us to believe, because many of you maybe already have Apple products, and it's still a niche company, believe it or not, globally. Globally, is still a niche company. The market share of just traditional Macs and laptops globally is like 5 or 6%. They say it's roughly 20% in the U.S. I'm not even sure that's true. There's a lot of the old Wintel, you know, world out there that we all use. But so just on the traditional Mac and laptop, it's still a niche company. And the more that you introduce iPhones and iPads around the world, the more that basic core franchise desktop and laptop business grows in market share. If that market share gets to even 10%, that makes the company much larger than it is today. That's just the legacy business, if you will, of laptop and desktop. iPhone still has amazing trajectory. You've got competitors like the BlackBerry that tried to cross over from the enterprise to the consumer that's struggling a bit. It feels a little bit like it could end up being a little bit of a two-horse race between Apple and all the Android products. You may have a bunch of different hardware providers, but in terms of kind of the two big players, right now anyway, it feels like Apple and Android, whether Samsung or HTC or Qualcomm or whoever makes that Android software phone, it could end up being a two-horse race in a global economy that wants handsets. That's a huge market. And then the tablet, the iPad is, in our financial projection, we had the iPad being in the middle of this calendar year, so the June we just passed, we had market share being 50% of the market. It's still like close to 80%. The competition just has not been there in tablets. It may come, you know, and Amazon's going to come out with something very soon. It might even be tomorrow, I think. But we'd assume that there'd be much better competition in the tablets. But it just hasn't happened yet. So they've got all kinds of momentum. It is fair to say that the Jobs thing, Steve Jobs, is a risk. The reality is a couple years ago when he first took his first healthcare leave of absence, we made a decision then, could we own Apple without it? Frankly, we were surprised he came back. We thought that was, I mean, look, his sickness was so horribly public. You know, it's been terrible, right? And we just decided 2 years ago, he's probably not coming back. Can we still own the company? We just thought we could, given the momentum and trajectory of their current products. I think a year from now, it's going to be in our opinion anyway, it's going to be a much bigger question, him being gone, what is the next thing? You know, every 2-3 years they've come out with some pretty interesting products. And even though they have upgrades to the current product cycle, what is the next big one that kind of keeps the trajectory going? And, you know, some people are speculating it could be, you know, like a living room type thing, a souped up Apple TV or whatever. But that clearly has been one of the things that he's done well. Not that he's personally designed those products, but he has been kind of the unifying force and the innovator to get the next big thing out there. And time will tell. And that, you know, the near-term momentum, we think, gets them through several quarters at least in terms of this huge growth rate. And by the way, all of these growth rates and numbers and market share and all this has all happened in an environment the last 3 years that have been, you know, relatively slow, right, relative to a normalized global economy. It's just blown through all discretionary income that we've all been squeezed on, and yet we're buying Apple products like crazy. So sorry if that was longer than you expected. And they definitely have too much cash to balance sheet. There's no doubt about it. That can be a good thing when the market's selling off 20%, but, you know, $75 billion in cash, whatever it is ridiculous. And we've told them.
Would you folks feel comfortable with the current makeup of the portfolio, say, under a sustained, say a scenario of sustained flat economic growth for 3, 4, 5 years?
Yeah, we have what we're kind of assuming, and to be clear up front, we don't necessarily think it's our core competency to call the market or the economic cycle, but, you know, you do have to have some kind of opinion, some kind of directional opinion. And our general sense, and this has been true for a few years now, is that the economy is moderate at best. So if everything worked perfectly, it could be a 3, 4, maybe even a 5%, which would be big numbers from here. That's the very best. We're not assuming we're necessarily double dipping or we're going back into another financial crisis. We're just kind of assuming flat-ish. We believe in, if anyone reads kind of Bill Gross at PIMCO, the new normal idea. That's generally something we agree with.
So you have thought of that then?
Yeah, and so that's kind of the base case for what we're doing in the portfolio, which is don't bet on cyclicality to get your company to be a winner. Some of these companies will do better in a better cyclical environment for sure, but where we have cyclical exposure, if all it is a cyclical play, that's the wrong bet, in our opinion. And so, you know, that's great and fine. We've been right on that. But on days, and you've even seen it the last 2 days, where we've had a little bit of recovery right off of you know, pretty hard sell-off and then a couple up days, we've lagged a bit in the last couple days. When the market gets a very cyclical flavor, we tend to lag, you know, because we're not really positioned that way. So yeah, we're not rooting for a flat economy, because I think for all of our, you know, we'd like it to be a great recovery, but we're assuming it's flat-ish or kind of low single digit or, you know, that type of
very good
economy.
Any other questions, members? Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Thanks for your time.
I think the iPhone i5 came out today, right?
You know, it's coming out, I think it's the 4th or 5th next week.
Yes.
They just announced that, they announced the date.
Yeah,
I think
October
it's the 4th. And I'll be able to.
Because Samsung Galaxy T goes on sale October 2nd.
This is the original, the classic.
Here in the
I still
US.
Own.
The classic.
I call it classic. And I've just kept it the whole time, and I don't know why. I'm going to get an iPhone 5. No, this is the original. This is before even the 3G. This is the very first iPhone right here. And that I bought in December of 2007. I was the first one to buy it on my team, and we had already bought the stock, partly based on the iPhone launch. And so I gave them a hard time. I'm like, I'm going with the actual bet on the company. And so because of that, I've just kept it. You know? But I actually do think I'm going to buy the iPhone 5.
In a case.
Yeah. I'm keeping this thing. This is going to be valuable someday. There are probably like, 5 million things sold. But yeah.
You haven't only picked them for so
much. You're holding back our portfolio. You need to buy.
Exactly. We've got to keep buying this product. Well, you know, you guys, I don't know if you've talked about it, but I'm doing more and more board meetings these days where everyone has, and I'm not trying to add to your your budget here, but everybody has iPads and these all
See?
On there.
We have it. We just need to make it work.
Yeah, no, I understand. It's not always as simple as it sounds.
I've got a tube tester at home.
Thank you, guys.
No, don't miss this one.
Paul, are you going to explain the market gyrations to us?
Yeah, he's got all the answers.
Bye, Bears.
Nice to see you. Echo Bears.
See
you soon.
Thank you, guys.
We have the monthly market update for the month of August, which was clearly a rough month. It has continued into September. For the month, the Russell 3000 was down 6%, bringing the last 3 months down roughly 10%, and year-to-date into negative territory. Small caps were weak, and weaker than the large cap counterparts, down 8.5%. And non-U.S. was also weak, down 8.5%, as the dollar has rallied during this recent sell-off. Bonds were positive due to mainly government bonds benefiting from a flight to safety and the Fed policy, I guess, twist, where they will use short-term bills maturing and proceeds buying longer-term dated securities. But that was in September, not August. But the bond rally has continued in September. A year-to-date, the BC aggregate is up 6% roughly. And again, it was primarily concentrated in the government sector for August and this past couple weeks. Page one, the portfolio stood at $1.33 billion at the end of August. Our asset classes are very close to targets. After our rebalancing, taking money out of equities into fixed income a couple months ago, which was, again, a good move given what's happened. And then the recent sell-off in equities has pushed that down further and fixed income up above its target now. Each of the individual managers are very close to targets pretty much. Page two, compared to the prior month, it was a heavy loss of $66 million. Primarily due to the equities, up $118 million from the prior year. I guess the only thing good you can say is it's happened in the first 2 or 3 months of the fiscal year, so there is some time to recover, and there is some hope that we will get a good recovery once we get past some of these macroeconomic events that are definitely playing havoc with the market's volatility and price levels. Page three.
Well, Paul, so that's almost 6% or in 1 month we lost?
That's 4.5%. The fund was down 4.5% in August.
4.7.
Okay. Yeah. You can see the individual managers' allocations to targets. I said they're quite close. You also step back, though, we're talking about the, you know, we had a huge recovery from the lows in March 2009. And almost, if you put all the macroeconomic events aside, we did rally roughly 100% in the equity markets from the lows of March 2009. And now we've corrected roughly 20%, you know, 18-20% after rallying 100%. And if you can put all the macroeconomic events aside for a second, which I'm not asking you really to do, but you think of a off of a steep decline and then a 100% move up, now we've corrected 20%. It's not shocking, I guess. It's not pleasant, but hopefully, you know, we'll be building a base at some point soon. Some say we can go down another 10-15% at another worst-case scenario. Who knows? But hopefully it's up 100, down 20, 25, whatever the number is, and then we start another nice, strong rally. Page four,
the cash levels are low at the equity levels. 18.7 million of the cash is in the fixed income managers. PIMCO has a large cash position. Sec lending down 2.6 million. And then on page five, the performance. And you can see for the month of August that unfortunately, not only was the policy index down, but we underperformed that. And we underperformed that for a couple reasons and a couple of the same reasons that we saw in the 2008 period were the same. Dodge and Cox on the equity side underperform like they have in the past during sharp sell-offs. You can see the last 2 months, and the 2 months make up the fiscal year-to-date numbers. On the good side was Delaware, as they just reported, and the cap prospects is held up okay on a relative basis. Everyone else is, well, there's a lot of passive money, so that's obviously close to the index. Overall, the equities were down 40 basis points for the month. Dodge and Cox has more money than Delaware, so their underperformance affected the total domestic equity. Plus, we have a overweight to small caps in relation to the Russell 3000, and small caps were much weaker, so that detracted from performance. That has small cap weighting has helped us for the prior 2 years to June 30th. On the fiscal year to date, we're down 50 basis points. Fixed income, Dodge and Cox, which had been holding up okay, really underperformed their benchmark. As I said, it was a benchmark, the DC aggregate, that governments were the strongest sector in that benchmark, and spread products, particularly corporates, began to widen in August, and Dodge and Cox was down a large amount on a relative basis and down 1.9% for the 2 months of the fiscal year to date. PIMCO has held up much better, very benchmark-like these 2 months. They do have a decent allocation to treasuries, which helped them. And then international equity, LSV, which had been very strong, did give some back these last 2 months. That would be the three out of four reasons why the fund has underperformed its policy index, the first being Dodge and Cox equity, the second being Dodge and Cox fixed income, the third LSV. Pyramus, fiscal year to date, up 42 basis points. The LSV has had a much lower impact on the underperformance than the two Dodge and Cox products. And the fourth is research affiliates. They're long short, once again underperformed by about 8%, down 16% since we hired them. It was a very poor first 2 months for them. But they are 1.5% of the total portfolio, even a little less now, and their impact was about 24 basis points on the total portfolio. So it's meaningful still, but it's not a huge impact, really, when you compare it to some other factors. And they have sent another email following that month of performance stating they are that two things have occurred. They are waiving our fee that we're paying them until we make up what we've lost, which, and two, that everyone at their firm has put in new money into the same product we're in since the end of August. So those are two welcome gestures that they didn't have to make.
Paul, it's just the group that gave us the email that said that Apple was a trendy company.
They have a different view than Delaware on Apple.
And it was better to be in European financials.
The reason of their underperformance is mainly twofold, as the email said, one is they tend to be long value style and short growth, and growth has decidedly outperformed the value style over the past couple of years, although we've only been in the product 2 months. And two, they are tend to be overweight Europe and the European financials as a sector, and that's obviously hurt them. They are, their largest short position is Apple. They made the point that Apple is now the largest market weighted cap company in the U.S. and the globe, yet it's the 40th largest company as far as profitability. And that's one key metric they look at on whether they're over or underweight a company.
Well, can you take a look and see if we've canceled ourselves out or if we're net long or short on Apple?
Yeah, I
will. As an organization, we're fighting ourselves?
We are definitely net long because the indices we own Apple too in large amounts. And Research Affiliates' dollar amount at $60 million is much less than Delaware plus the...
So they're kind of a hedge against...
Yeah, they kind of bring down the... Well, if you're worried that we're too heavy in Apple,
yeah,
they actually bring us down a little bit. But I will do that. We were talking, Nate and I, before the meeting, that we need to, on the top 10 holdings, we need to add Research Affiliates long short, their top 10 long and top 10 short holdings to that list. So we're going to do that. Yeah. Overall, the fund was down 4.5% versus 3.4% for the month of August, and it's down 5.3% versus 4.0% for the fiscal year to date. Continuing the individual rolling 3 years for the managers, page 6, Dodge & Cox Equity. The recent 2 months has brought them back down to 0% on rolling 3 years. Should be noted, the due diligence committee will be going to San Francisco and visiting Dodge & Cox in Delaware and the index provider, BlackRock, and our own firm, SIS, coming up first week of October. Delaware, page 7, obviously it's been a very strong run as per their commentary and recent outperformance. It's kind of nice to see that. An active manager doing what you pay them to do. Page 8, Pyramus has been, the trend's been good for the last few years, although it's kind of also kind of flat at 0% right now also. LSV had been very strong, going from minus 1 to plus 2.5 on a rolling 3-year, and the last couple months has gone back a little bit. I'm not concerned about them. Invesco has been relatively at the minus 1% level. And Dodge & Cox Fix, you can see the volatility, the tremendous downturn in 2008, followed by 2+ years of very strong performance, and then the recent downturn again as spreads have widened in the corporate section. So it's been a challenging month. September has been challenging also. Last week was not fun. This week has been a little better, as the markets continue to exhibit high volatility and almost waiting for solutions from policymakers on large macroeconomic issues like European sovereign debt and in the U.S. on the deficits and budgets also. And because policymakers often disappoint, and until I think Europe is resolved with some credible solution, we'll continue to see some volatility. I think the good news is on the equity side, by just valuations, companies appear to be very, very cheap. A lot of good companies are now selling at 10, 11, 12 times earnings in an interest rate environment where interest rates are very low at 2%. And generally, that's a good prescription for a good rally coming up. But as we've seen the last few months, you can be screaming, equities are cheap, and you're getting run over by a train because the train happens to be these macroeconomic events that need to be solved. So we're definitely seeing kind of a seesaw, and we'll see how it plays out.
So, Paul, for Research Affiliates, we've had 2 months of minus 8% each. And is it likely to be much different for September?
I don't think it's going to be good. It's good, but I don't think it'll be. I'll have to find out. I'm not sure. I sense it'll be better than minus eight. I know the last couple of days, a lot of the financials have rallied, and Europe has rallied, and some of these tech stocks that they're short have slowed down in recent days. So I suspect they're making money on the short side, and their long portfolio is probably down, but not to the extent it had been in August and September.
Okay, thank you.
But we'll get them posted on the, which we'll go over right now, the price monitor position report. We'll get them posted on that starting next month. The price monitor position report for August. The first is for BlackRock large cap growth. You can see Apple is the top position in the large cap growth position, and it's weighted at 5.8%, roughly the 6% Kevin alluded to at the end of August, and was a very strong performer in August. Schlumberger was the weak performer. Oil was very weak, has been weak as the price has declined to below $80 a barrel yesterday. We're rallying a few bucks today. Next is the large cap value index, BlackRock. Financials have also been very weak in August. JP Morgan down 13.5, the supposedly bellwether of the group, of the banks, money center banks, and Wells Fargo down 6.8%. Next page is capital prospects. They have the three middle positions down sharply, but you know the others have been close to what the benchmark. The Russell 2000 value continues to be the weaker benchmark, down 3.9% as of September 19th, month to date. Delaware continues to perform well in September, as they alluded to. Their top four positions were all adding value on a relative basis and an absolute basis. They were all up strong.
Hey, Paul.
Yes.
Would it be possible to squeeze in the benchmark weights on these things, on the active side, on the active portfolios, so you can see the overweight or underweight?
Yeah, we can try that.
Because, you know,
because we have a lot of those weights from the index funds, actually, yeah.
Well, like, so Apple's, I didn't realize Apple was 5% of the Russell 1000.
Yeah, we can do that, Rick.
All right.
Yep, good idea. Let me just make a note, because I forget. Yeah, that's an important piece.
I think Apple's doubled in the last 12 to 18 months, so that's part of the reason why its percentage is so high.
Well, it'd be interesting to see how overweight some of these managers are in certain stocks.
Yeah. It really only applies to Dodge and Cox.
Right, and Delaware.
Delaware and the two small cap managers, right. Yeah. Dodge and Cox, speaking of them on the next page, again, they appear to be, they did struggle in August as reported. Hewlett-Packard had been a mess with management and acquisitions. They announced just in the past couple of days that Meg Whitman will be taking control. No comment. The financials, Capital One and Wells Fargo, were both weak. What's that?
She's going to bring in this quarter.
Okay.
What?
The stock did rally.
Yeah.
Maybe a rally because the old guy was gone. the market did not like him. Their financials and oils were also weak. And then next page, Legato. They did have large performance swings each way. Top three up, fourth down, and Tenet Healthcare was down also. I think we started to see some money rotate out of these defensive stocks in recent days that had been holding up relatively well, the healthcare names, a lot of the consumer, like Procter & Gamble type names. And there's starting to be some rotation out of those names. The S&P 500 index on the next page, the mega caps are holding up really well compared to the mid and small caps, and you see it in the top few names, the relative change. The last column on the right, Apple, IBM, Microsoft, and Chevron all performing well on a relative basis. And then the international equities, LSV, for August through September 19th, we're generally having good results on a relative basis with a few of their names, which hopefully will translate to outperformance in September. And Pyramus was kind of a mixed bag, the last manager. Their top name, Royal Dutch, up on a relative basis, but holding UBS, their ninth position, certainly didn't help, and with the recent turmoil there, will be a underperformance for the month of September. Okay, if there are no questions, we have two items left. That shouldn't take too much time. One is on the, I think Gordon correctly asked about the security lending collateral pool and kind of under the hood, what's
who's
under.
Who's loaning to who and where's Cross all this stuff going?
Right. So we have a email from Janice Colombo, who's our contact at BNY Mellon, our custodian on security lending and collateral pools. And we have a holdings report as of 9/15, which is 4 pages long. And you can see a lot of good has been done, but there's still, I think, some work to be done going forward. Repos are collateralized by generally T-bills or corporate or C or a commercial paper. So although Barclays is a European financial, but at least one that's not a French or Greek type of financial, a UK financial, that if they went under, we would have immediate access to the collateral that they put up, which is 102%.
Now, how do I read this? I mean, mm-hmm. We've loaned part of our portfolio.
Yes.
To other parties.
Yes.
So somewhere in this, somewhere in the portfolio and the different managers, some of this stuff is held?
Yes. We have loaned, well, this, we have loaned out stocks generally and bonds to other parties, whether they're hedge funds or whatever type of institutions. In return for loaning out these securities, they have to place generally cash instruments with us.
Is this a list of what we've loaned out?
No, this is a list of how we've invested the sec lending money that's come back to us.
So if something happens internationally like it did before,
yes,
and we lost some money in our lending program, it's because some of our stuff we loaned out was trapped?
I think the issue is, and you see on page one, is how we invest the security lending collateral in this pool that some, you know, the big investment that hurt us was Lehman Brothers.
Right.
So the question is, are some of these other investments potentially another Lehman Brothers? That's what would hurt us the most.
What about just the sheer connections between the various parties?
I don't think, I mean, it's an issue, but we saw Lehman Brothers was a huge counterparty in securities lending, and we didn't lose any money by them going bankrupt from the lending part.
Now, when we loan, do we know if we're involved with people outside of the United States?
Yes, we can get a list of that, but the answer is yes.
So if we are lending, say, through a French bank that goes under,
right,
then again we could be caught?
Right. I would have to get a list of that side, too. This is just a list of the collateral investments.
Right. So, I mean, this tells me part, but not the other half.
Okay, I understand. Yes.
I guess I'm generally concerned, I don't know if the rest of the group is, that if things do go bad,
right,
if Greece or somebody defaults and a French bank or somebody else is caught,
right,
there'll be periods of time of uncertainty.
Right, just like when Lehman went under.
Right.
Although, and my point is, when Lehman went under, there was enough backstop in the system to prevent us losing money.
Well, it was more U.S. too, to me.
Right, exactly. Now,
under,
right,
I felt better regulations.
Now, the hope would be that BNY Mellon is choosing their partners on the,
okay,
carefully, but let me get a copy of that list.
Second of all, in general,
mm-hmm,
securities lending works better when interest rates are high and,
yes,
less when interest rates are low.
Yes.
It's got to be the worst time in the world to be lending.
Yes, it's not a great
so
time.
So what I see is a whole risk with less return.
Well, that's why I think on this holdings report, on the investment of the collateral, we should make some changes on how it's being
invested. What about just scaling down the whole program?
Well, that's an option that's going to...
I mean, how much are we gaining from our security lending in this low-interest environment?
Yeah, it's,
I think, well, you're eliminating pretty much most of the risk anyway by the assets that you invest in.
Yes,
and
we are. 102%
of collateral as well. So there's not a whole lot of risk here as long as what you invest is very short-term and very,
right,
safe.
And I would propose that we rewrite our guidelines going further so that as investments in this collateral pool mature, get put into government or repo type of investments with primary dealers, that would protect us even more.
Any way to restrict it to U.S.?
And we can restrict it to the U.S., yes.
I mean, I'm not as concerned with,
right,
the regulations that we're under than we're going to be in international courts trying to figure out.
Right.
I don't want to mess with those foreigners.
I don't want to go under their rules.
Well, my first question is why? Why do we want to do this as opposed to other equities or other people? Is it because this is more liquid, or?
You mean do securities lending,
yeah,
at all?
Mm-hmm.
It's a way to pick up extra income, but the caveat is the world has changed so much in the past few years that a lot of the risk has multiplied.
And the return is reduced.
The return is now reduced because
the interest rates are so low.
And just lending activity is low, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, the risk-reward is kind of
we would have to We would have to find out what the procedures would be for unwinding a program. And then also, which is secondary, believe me, it's secondary, what the overall effect would be on the custodian relationship.
Yeah.
We can do that. But I would suggest also that we should go ahead on the collateral pool and write stricter guidelines for investment.
Anything to improve.
Okay. And we'll bring that to you next month as part of the alternative package. And
I just think that we're getting into high risk and low return.
It's, yeah. And I think there's counterparty risk, like you said, and we'll get a list of the other parties involved. I mean, I've seen BNP as a counterparty in security lending all over the place. So.
Yeah. And hopefully there won't be a problem. But.
Oh, yeah. I think on the collateral pool, the custodians have already gone to a much more conservative position, but there's no reason. Like you said, interest rates are so low anyway that investing in short-term government securities versus agencies, it's not going to be much of a difference in return anyway. Okay. I'll come back next month. And the last item is a verbal update on the RBC Diversified Infrastructure Fund. I think staff and myself got a little bit of a surprise phone call a couple weeks ago or 10 days ago informing us that RBC has decided to, before it was even up and running, terminate the infrastructure fund that we had verbally committed a allocation and dollar amount to. And it was a little bit of a shock, but I guess not a total one. and no money has been placed with them, which is the good news. And the, I forgot the gentleman's name, but the person who called us was the head of RBC Americas in Boston, has verbally stated that they will reimburse this fund for all legal expense and other administration expense associated with making, doing due diligence and making a commitment to this. So
that was what our outside attorney we hired to review?
Yes. So,
Paul, what was the reason?
The reason that was given by RBC was that they just didn't think they had raised enough funds to make it worthwhile going forward. We were told that RBC had committed up to about $50 million on the corporate side, split between the corporate and the pensions, 25 each roughly, plus our commitment. And the first close was anticipated to be about $86.6 million. That obviously is not going to happen. I think it's, I talked to Whit Porter from the team, the infrastructure team in Boston. He had a little different viewpoint than RBC corporate, but I think it's, he said and she said, and maybe the truth's in the middle, like a lot of these things are, but obviously it was a lot of time and effort spent, but I am relieved that not a dollar left this pension fund to go into that, and I guess chalk it up to a lesson learned. And I think at the moment, with the volatility in the markets, we'll just step back and let things see if they calm down before, you know, going forward with anything else. But we already have a couple investments in the special situations fund and would like to.
Well, I thought they were telling us all along that we had to do this fast. It was closed, filling up. They're going to open up another fund. I mean, isn't that what they were telling us?
I'm not sure. I'm a little confused by the whole thing. But I think the team was telling us, you know, we want to close. They wanted to close 6 months ago, it sounded like. I think the corporate's saying, you guys didn't raise enough money to make this viable.
The more people, the more groups they had invested into it, would look good to others. And that's kind of.
Although the team would give you a different response than the corporate, than RBC corporate. And we had saw, you know, Jim Roberts, who was kind of the rep for them, left RBC also a couple of months ago, and then this happened. I don't know if A plus B equals C or what, but.
Paul, does this indicate that there was a shortfall in our due diligence?
No, not at all. I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, our understanding was they were going to go up and, you know, close this with the first round of us in RBC, and more money was going to be on its way. So I'll have to think about it, lesson learned. But maybe you're right, Mike, that we should.
I mean, we scoped this out pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, we scoped. I mean,
the lesson is over the last 6 months, this world has changed so much.
It has.
And I think RBC made the decision to pull the plug. I don't know that we could have anticipated that or if there was any due diligence we could have done to change it. I mean, RBC is a big organization.
Right.
And like a lot of big ones, they change their mind.
I think you're right, though. Maybe the lesson learned in these type of investments, you would want a bigger type of fund going in.
Existing.
Or a new fund that's raised, you know, $500 million to a billion or what, you know. That, I think you're right in that regard.
Okay. So they are going to reimburse us for all those costs.
That is my understanding. Yes.
Do we submit a bill, or
this is the thing that we want
to come up with? Well, we have a legal bill to submit, I guess.
Right, and we have received a couple of documents which we forwarded to counsel, legal counsel, that basically amends the initial document so that it can be dissolved, and then a document
right.
that dissolves it, that says, yeah, we're one of the partners and we wish to dissolve it. And so I want to make sure that we do have that in writing about the reimbursement of the expenses, and then we'll move forward to billing.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Is that it, Paul? Tom?
Okay, we received information from NCPERS, National Conference on Public Employee Retirement Systems, that they want to submit a response to the GASB Statement 2527 exposure draft, and their joint response is both the NCPERS and it's actually National Council on Teachers Retirement, NCTR, and the National Association of State Retirement Administrators, NASRA, related to the GASB Statement 2527 exposure draft. All the board members received the joint response draft. They have amended it a little bit. Also, SACRS has submitted or will be submitting a draft or a response to the GASB Statement 2527 on behalf of the 37 Act systems. But NCPERS would like us to sign on as a member of NCPERS onto their draft so that they can show that a large number of public employee pension systems oppose a lot of what the GASB Statement 2527 changes will be, or if there have to be some changes, at least rewording some of them to conform with statute, law, and so on. I did a cover on that, and I'm recommending that we go ahead and support this joint response document by sending in our chair's name, Mike Lynch, as retirement board chair of our system, and that's all our effort needs to be to be part of that response.
Any comments or discussion, members?
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to adopt the staff recommendation in the letter. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carried unanimously. I don't know why.
Also noting the response initially was I think September 30th, now they've extended to October 14th. So we still have time.
Okay, committee reports. Jim?
Okay, due diligence committee met. We have a schedule of the visits that we have planned. We just got it by year in this report, but we're going October 5th and 6th to San Francisco to visit Delaware and Black Rock on 5th, Dodge and Cox and CIS on the 6th. So that's coming up about a week.
Next week.
So I don't know, we're going to go look around and see.
Yeah, are you going to have on this list eventually? Are you going to have research affiliates?
I don't know. That didn't come up at the time. You know,
we normally do visits once in 3 years.
Okay.
Yeah, about once in 3 years. So they can certainly be added next year.
In 2012, we haven't actually set the day that we're going yet. We have people with different schedules, and you know, it's. We have to do it well ahead in advance. We had a really difficult time just picking October 5th and 6th to try and make it work for everybody.
Okay, do we have a motion to approve the committee report? Or is that, do we need that? We don't need that. Okay. All right. And I understand we do not need a closed session. So we're at members' forum. Why don't we start with Ron?
Nothing.
Darren?
Nothing.
Gordon?
Yeah, actually, we're getting close, I hope, to having a county administrator. Oh. And I'm hoping that when we do, our administrator will get a chance to meet with the county administrator, talk about various things. One of the things that's come up with our group before is to what extent this group is even concerned with what the county does or employees or what are consequences of our actions. And I was looking at some of the legal filings we've been getting on our behalf. We have some court cases we've been involved in. And I thought one section, if you pass that around, of course, pass that around, was very interesting, that was filed on our behalf, that basically says there is some degree of concern on our part as to whether or not employees lose their jobs. which kind of surprised me. So as long as our legal counsel is filing stuff on our behalf, the court's saying that, I guess we should be aware of it.
Legal counsel in terms of the county?
Yeah. No, account the Stansera. This is from our Stansera filings.
I seem to recall that our fiduciary counsel briefed us on this. I've been aware of it for some time.
Okay.
So, I'm...
If that, I'll pass.
I think that's why the board took the action that it did when it did.
Mr. O'Neill, any comments?
No, thank you.
Donna?
None for me.
I think so.
Staff, anybody?
Thank you.
Okay, meeting's adjourned.
Thank you.